From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the second day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. In the second half hour of our program today, we call that The Farming World, and it appears on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org. We'll be joined by John Shaw, the president of the American Farmland Trust. So stay with us for this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby July wheat at $4.42.5, down 8.25 cents today. September at $4.60.25, down 8, and December at $4.91.5, down 7.25. In Kansas City, July softer red, hard red at $4.73.75, down 4.25. From the corn pit now, July futures there, $3.48.5, down 5.5. September at $3.58.75, 5.25 lower. And December at $3.69.75, down 5.5 cents. March corn at $3.83.25, down a nickel for the day. Crude oil futures at $72.86 a barrel, down or rather up 28 cents. July soybeans at $9.32.5, a half higher. August at $9.20.25, down a half. And September at $9.09, up a half for the day. November beans at $9.03.5, 0.75 cents higher. July bean meal futures at $271.40 settlement price, up $2. July bean oil at $37.42. A dime lower on the day. June live cattle futures, $92.05, up $1.25. August there at $90.75, $1.12.5 higher. August feeders at $109.65, 17.5 cents higher. And September's at $109.52.5, up 62.5 cents. June lean hog futures, $81.32.5, down 7.5 cents. July at $82.17.5, down 57.5 cents on this Wednesday afternoon. Of course, you're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Distillers Greg Grant dried grains at 101. This is just a brand new thing that came out, and it's unchanged on the afternoon. We'll talk more about that during our program today. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil again at $73.30 a barrel, up 73 cents. June ethanol at $1.60, down 0.2. Natural gas at $4.42.6, 17.7 cents higher. July heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.04, up 4.4. And the gold futures at $1,220.60 an ounce. A settlement price there for the day, down $4.20. The Dow at 10,183, just about 200 points higher for the day. The U.S. dollar at 86.79 is up 0.14. And the CRB index at 252.67 is 0.28 higher on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the Midwest says. Thunderstorms overnight produced pockets of heavy rain in Iowa, northwestern Illinois, and northern Missouri. Lighter rain fell across the remainder of the region last night. Additional showers, a few thunderstorms, should occur periodically over the next few days. That'll slow field work occasionally, but assure abundant soil moisture. Temperatures should be seasonable over the coming week, with daily highs in the 70s and 80s. That'll be followed by lows in the 50s and the 60s. No dominating high-pressure ridge is anticipated in the heart of the Midwest for at least a week. Some ridge building is possible late next week. Hot weather will develop in southwestern part of the U.S. Plains this weekend, and that should be closely monitored. A more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and talk with Drew Lerner.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. On the phone line with us this afternoon, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, to take a look at the agricultural futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Did you get rainfall there last night?
We got about 7 to 8 tenths in our growing area. That's Brockton, Newman, and Oakland here. And we understand that was fairly common, and we're in good shape here. It's very much what we call corn-growing weather here in Oakland, Illinois.
And yesterday afternoon, USDA approved that, too, when they got the ratings back from the producers, said that they have an awfully good corn crop out there and maybe even a little better at this point than they had at this same time last year.
The ratings were 76%, and a year ago at 70, last week 71. The wheat ratings were also rated very high. There is some dry pockets in northwest Iowa and Nebraska, and as a general rule, the only weather problems that we can also talk about is there's a feeling that Dakotas will plant more soybeans, less corn, and there could even be some preventive planting in that geographic area because it's too wet again this year.
You know, we record the statisticians from the five top corn-producing states, and we'll hear that here in another, 4 or 5 minutes on the radio station. When I listened to what Iowa had to say yesterday afternoon, it surprised me that they don't sound nearly as good about their crop as the rest of the Midwest, and there are some problems with that crop. What do you hear from your clientele there?
Well, of course, they did say, I did talk to Des Moines during the middle part of the day, and of course he said the middle part of the state's pretty darn good, maybe a little too wet in the southeast part, a little too dry in the northwest. But I didn't get the feeling that it's a bad crop or anything like that at this time. The only thing that everybody says is we have a long time here. The other point about the weather that I think needs to be brought up is that one of my weathermen sent me this deal about the temperature and degree day, and we're, 3 to 4 degree days a day, as far as temperatures above normal are concerned. And as a result of that, if that trend would continue and we ever do turn dry, that's always something nervous, but there's a lot of ifs in there, and Mother Nature and the weather forecaster has lots of twists and turns. But right now it's a pretty aggressively, as we say, good corn-growing weather for at least the next 10 days to 2 weeks.
As we closed out the month of May, Paul, most of our analysts were turning at least friendly to the corn market. Where should they be today?
Well, unfortunately, between Spain, Greece, and a lot of the political winds, the official trend is down. Today's close under the 374 level is bad, and there's nothing on the political horizon that we see with ethanol, unfortunately, to kind of jump start things. We don't see anything as far as new demand from China coming in, so a person has to be somewhat defensive. I'd be lying to you if I told you anything different. The trend is officially lower. The only thing I can say is it's very cheap, and we don't like to sell stuff when it's cheap. Fortunately, we made all of our major decisions on the 2009 crop being sold out at higher levels. The beans, of course, were sold both in old and new crop at higher levels, but the corn market, unfortunately, is down, and it's going to be a tough problem here in the next 30 to 60 days unless we do have some kind of demand or weather to turn us around.
Are you going to wait it out for those who haven't made the sales?
Well, I don't know about those that haven't. My official deal is you'd be out of everything above the $4 mark, and we encourage that. As far as the new crop, we do think that a person does have some time to make those necessary sales, you know, in the future. I just don't want to think how to do something bad if I've already done something good.
Okay, thanks so much.
Have a profitable day, Todd.
Hey, you too. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Wednesday afternoon, we'll take a look at USDA's crop progress report. As of May 30th, it said that producers had planted 97% of this year's corn crop nationwide. That's 5 percentage points ahead of last year and slightly ahead of the 5-year average. Emergence had advanced to 85% complete by the week's end, compared with 71% last year and 80% on the rolling 5-year average. Warm temperatures promoted emergence of 16 percentage points or more throughout much of the Great Plains and Great Lakes region during the past week. Overall, 76% of the corn crop is up and growing and in good to excellent condition. That's up 5 percentage points ratings from last week and 6 percentage points better than last year. On the soybeans, producers planted 21% of the nation's crop during the week, leaving progress at 74% complete. 11 percentage points ahead of last year, slightly behind the 5-year average. Sunny, mostly dry weather allowed for double-digit planting progress in all estimating states, with one exception. That was Mississippi. Emergence advanced to 46% complete by the week's end, 13 points ahead of last year and 2 percentage points ahead of the 5-year average. Emergence was most rapid in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, where above-average temperatures promoted progress of 30 percentage points or more during the week. And finally, on the winter wheat, nationally 75% of the 2010 crop was at or beyond the heading stage by May the 30th, slightly behind both last year and the 5-year rolling average. Ideal growing conditions promoted head development of 31 percentage points or more in Colorado, Michigan, Ohio, and Oregon during the week. Overall, 65% of the winter wheat crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's down slightly from the week previous, but 20 percentage points better than this time last year. Now, here are the state statisticians with the numbers from Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Indiana.
This is Brad Parks, Deputy Director from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Iowa Field Office, with the weekly Crops and Weather Report for the week ending May 30th, 2010. A warm, sunny week throughout most of Iowa advanced crop progress and gave farmers a chance to catch up on field work. Farmers in southeast Iowa were finally able to get back into the fields after several weeks of limited field work and focus on getting crops in the ground. Numerous producers reported replanting due to seedling rot, crusted soil, and hail damage. By week's end, a majority of farmers completed their planting and concentrated on spraying to control weeds and harvesting hay. Corn and soybeans are being reported mostly in good condition throughout the state. However, South Central and Southeast Iowa are reporting a significant percentage of acres in very poor to poor condition. Contributing to these conditions in Southern Iowa is the abundance of moisture, while Northwest Iowa is in need of rain to help late planted soybeans emerge. Almost all the corn acreage has been planted. Corn acreage emerged was 94%, ahead of the 88% last year and the 5-year average of 87%. Corn condition rated 1% very poor, 4% poor, 21% fair, 54% good, and 20% excellent. Soybean acreage planted increased 16 percentage points to 91%, similar to the 89% last year and 88% for the 5-year average. Soybeans emerged reached 62%, 7 percentage points ahead of last year and 10 percentage points ahead of the 5-year average. Soybean condition rated 1% very poor, 5% poor, 23% fair, 53% good, and 18% excellent. Again, this has been Brad Parks, Deputy Director from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending May 30th, 2010. Thank you.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending May 30th. Isolated showers, some heavy at times, caused variable amounts of precipitation across the state last week. However, most of Illinois experienced above normal temperatures and below normal precipitation. Statewide, corn planting is virtually finished at 99% complete. This is ahead of last year's 79% and the five-year average of 94%. Emergence advanced to 94%, compared to 48% emerged last year and 82% for the five-year average. The average height of emerged corn now stands at 11 inches, compared with 5 inches last year and 7 inches for the five-year average. Overall, the corn crop was rated in mostly good condition. However, there were widespread areas of yellow corn due to compaction and nitrogen deficiencies. Soybean planting advanced to 73% complete, compared to 31% planted last year and 71% for the five-year average. 49% of soybeans have emerged, compared to 5% a year ago and 45% for the five-year average. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 62% of the heads filled, compared with 49% 1 year ago and 56% for the five-year average. 21% of the fields were reported turning yellow, compared to 12% last year and 22% for the five-year average. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending May 30th, 2010. Sunshine and warm temperatures provided crops with improved growing conditions this past week. Accumulated growing degree days moved closer to normal levels and aided crop emergence. Corn conditions rated 16% fair, 71 good, and 13 excellent. Planting of corn neared completion statewide. Corn emerged was 79% complete, behind last year's 92 and 88 average. Soybean planting progressed to 85% complete, behind last year's 96 and 86 average. Soybeans emerged was 43%, behind last year's 68 and 52 average. Sorghum planting was at 47% complete, while dry bean planting was 14% complete. Wheat conditions rated 77% good or excellent, above the 75% of last year. Wheat headed out was 33%, behind last year and the average of 62. The South Central District was further along in development. Disease concerns were noted in some southeastern and south central counties. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAST Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending May 30th, 2010. Warm temperatures and adequate moisture produced good growing conditions for crops. As of Sunday, May 30th, 90% or greater of small grains and row crops were rated in good to excellent condition. Producers continued to plant remaining crops and began herbicide applications. Precipitation for most of the state was below normal, though northern areas received over 3 inches in localized areas. Reports of strong winds and hail in some areas contributed to slowed fieldwork in much of the northwest. Corn was 94% emerged with an average height of 5 inches. Soybeans planted advanced to 95% complete, and 60% of the crop had emerged, with an average height of 2 inches. Both crops were rated 92% in good to excellent condition. 25% of the spring wheat and 26% of the barley was jointing. 52% of oats were jointing, and 3% were heading. All three small grains were rated 90% or greater in good to excellent condition. Potato planting neared completion with 97% planted. Sunflowers were 86% planted. That's 38 percentage points ahead of last year and 16 points ahead of the average. Sweet corn was 62% planted, 3 points behind last year and 5 points ahead of average. That's the weekly crop weather report for the week ending May 30th, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana, and this is the crop weather report for the week ending May 30th. Sunshine and warmer weather dried soils enough to allow farmers to resume planting. The corn planting neared completion in many northern and central counties, along with some replanting of low spots and areas with poor emergence. Some farmers are worried that weeds are becoming large enough to resist herbicide treatments. 94% of the intended corn acreage has been planted, ahead of last year's 75% and 89% for the five-year average. 86% of the planted corn acreage has emerged, ahead of the 48% recorded for last year at this time and the 74% for the five-year average. Corn condition for the week was rated as 69% good to excellent, compared with 65% for last year at this time. 70% of the intended soybean acreage has been planted, compared to 46% for last year and 69% for the five-year average. By area of the state, 72% has been planted in the north, 75% in the central region, and 55% in southern Indiana. 52% of the planted soybean acreage has emerged, ahead of the 19% recorded for last year at this time and the 42% for the five-year average. 93% of the winter wheat acreage is headed, compared with 88% last year and 89% for the five-year average. Winter wheat condition is rated 72% at good to excellent, compared to 76% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm Todd Gleason at Illinois Public Media Studios in Urbana-Champaign. You're listening to the Closing Market Report.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson. Since 1985, offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com. Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, time to check in on the agricultural cash grain market. On the line with us today is Scott Butcher of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. Thanks, Scott, for filling in for Matt. I appreciate that.
No problem.
Tell me about cash grain movement in your area.
Things are a little slow right now, Todd. We're not seeing a lot of activity. Most of the guys in our area, although it is wet, seems like they've still been doing other things rather than marketing grain. I don't think looks like that's going to continue for a little while anyway until we get side dressing and some of those other things finished up.
Today's action didn't scare them enough to get them on the phone talking to you?
No, I think any kind of bearish activity we see right now just makes it worse. It doesn't get any movement going. It actually stops it.
And what do you see in the basis? Has it tightened up in this time frame?
Basis has tightened up. We've seen cash basis in most markets get a little bit stronger, and looks like that's going to continue here for the next few weeks.
In your area, I know that in previous months and weeks that they had been paying an over for soybeans. Is that still the case?
Yeah, most of the processor market in our area is anywhere from 20 to 30 over right now, with some of them getting close to 40.
And what are your bids for the day?
Right now for cash corn, we are 2 under the July. Beans, we are 3 under the July.
Thank you so much for being with us.
No problem.
And that is Scott Butcher. He's with the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. More with the CMR in just 2 minutes when we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the National Association of Realtors says that pending sales of previously owned U.S. homes rose more than expected in April, scaling a six-month high as prospective homeowners took advantage of a popular home buyer tax credit. The pending home sales index, based on contracts signed in April, increased 6%. To 110.9, the highest since October. It was the third straight month of gains in the index. Compared to April of 2009, the index was 22.4% higher. Trading experts summoned by the top U.S. securities regulator are expected to peel back layers of the complicated marketplace today, nearly a month after the dramatic flash crash confirmed some long-held concerns over its stability. The roundtable, conceived earlier this year, also comes as the regulator digests more than 200 letters in response to its wide-ranging paper on trading and market structure. And the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization has launched a website to track and help prevent the global spread of wheat stem rusts, including UG99, a devastating strain that poses a global threat to production. The Rome-based FAO says that there are concerns that the fungus could march across Africa and head toward South Asia. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On the phone line, Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon, Todd.
We had a little rainfall overnight, and I guess there are some thunderstorms that have been rumbling around the Midwest. Tell me about them.
Well, those thunderstorms have been quite variable in their intensity throughout the morning today. We've had some reports of hail. There's been some strong wind in a few locations as well. Most of these thunderstorms, though, will be dissipating as we go through the middle part of the day, but only temporarily. It will be back with a great deal of vengeance, possibly, as we get into the evening hours. A good chance that we'll see some strong thunderstorms popping up again as we get into, I would say, sometime after, let's say about after 7 o'clock tonight, there ought to be some fairly good storms going off across the parts of Michigan, and there may be some more that will pop up in Illinois. I don't think that the Illinois showers and thunderstorms will be all that significant until we get to the wee hours of the morning, and then perhaps we'll see them fire up into something a little bit more mean in southern Indiana, actually, and moving off to the east from there. But anyway, we're in a mode right now that is going to generate frequent showers and thunderstorms across the Midwest. This is really a very good environment for developing crops. The only problem is if we've got field work that's left over out there, it's going to take a little while to get that completed. The good thing is daily temperatures are going to be getting up into the 70s and some 80s still over this next few days, and that should help to keep the evaporation rates going good enough that we can dry out fairly quickly after the rains pass. There is a little bit of a northwesterly flow pattern trying to develop as we move into next week, about midweek. That might bring some cooler air into the region and kind of drop those temperatures a little bit below average. But we're still going to be pumping some shower and thunderstorm activity across the region. So for those who are worried about drought in June, I don't think we have to be too serious about that right now.
I listened to you on your second broadcast with the pre-opening market report and Dave Dickey this morning from Illinois Public Media. Heard you mention that it was going to be hot and dry in the Southwest. Can you tell me more about it?
Yes, there's a little region in New Mexico and Texas that is going to get very hot over the next two or three days. Temperatures are going to get over 100 degrees. And it looks like it's going to expand a little bit as time moves forward. And so the southwest part of the U.S. is going to get downright hot, and we're going to stress some livestock in the southern U.S. plains. We're going to speed along the winter wheat crops so that its harvest will move quickly. But some of the unirrigated sorghum and corn and peanuts that are produced in the southern plains along with the cotton crop will all be stressed as we go through the next 7 to 10 days as that heat becomes centralized in Texas and New Mexico. And some of the heat will work its way up into into southeastern parts of Colorado and southwestern Kansas. But that's probably about as far as it's going to get for a little while because this jet stream is just too strong right now to allow the heat to bubble up too far to the north.
And finally, if you could check in, we have about a minute left on China, please.
The storms that have occurred across China in recent weeks has certainly set back some field work across the northeast part of the country. It was cool and wet for quite some time. That's changing now. We're going to get very warm. 80s and 90s will occur in the northeast corner of that country, and that will likely stimulate much better planting conditions for the soybean crop. Most of the corn is now in the ground, but it did go in late. And a little bit further to the south in the Yellow River Basin, it's kind of east-central sections of China, we're drying out rather significantly right now. There's a definite need for rain across that region. They do irrigate a fair amount of the crop there, but at some point in the very near future, they're going to need a much greater amount of rain. The next 7 days will be pretty dry.
That's Drew Lerner. I'm Todd Gleason. This has been the Closing Market Report. This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with John Scholl. He's the president of the American Farmland Trust based in Washington, D.C. Mr. Scholl, thank you so much for being with us. Why don't you give us first a little background on yourself, where you came from, and then tell us about the American Farmland Trust.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Todd, and thank you for the chance to visit with you today. I think, you know, I'm an avid listener of what you do. I think your program is fantastic, and I'm honored to be a part of it today. As you know, I'm actually from Central Illinois. I'm still very much involved in the family farming operation just outside of Bloomington, Illinois, and here over the last several years, I've had some terrific opportunities from a career standpoint to get involved in some other things, which has brought me to Washington, D.C., where I now serve as president of the American Farmland Trust, but I still consider Cooksville, Illinois, home, and I try to get there as often as I can. The American Farmland Trust is a national conservation organization that's been in existence for about 30 years. We're just celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, and we're really focused on protecting farmland, promoting sound stewardship of agricultural land, and helping to ensure the economic viability of farms, ranches, and rural communities. We think we serve as an important bridge between a lot of environmental and agricultural interests, and we certainly try to be a proponent of new thinking and aggressive approaches to address environmental and conservation concerns in agriculture, but always with an eye towards the economics of the industry. If farmers can't make money, then clearly we understand that there's a lot more pressure to sell the land to the highest bidder, which is usually a developer, or to take shortcuts or not make the investment in conservation work that we think is very important to the long-term sustainability of agriculture.
Well, let's take that up in just a bit in a unique way. Estate tax is now making its way back through Washington, D.C., and there are many ideas about the estate tax, why it should be in place, what are good things and what are bad things. How does the American Farmland Trust view the estate tax?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the first point I would make is that we look at a lot of different ways in which we try to protect farmland and promote sound stewardship. And I would guess most of your listeners might not necessarily think of the estate tax as being one of the first issues that we'd think about in that context. But in fact, the way the estate tax plays out right now is when an estate passes to the next generation, it is in fact taxed on the potential value of that land in whatever economic use that it might be put into, the highest potential economic use, as opposed to the actual use, which in the case of farms quite often is a lot lower value or it doesn't generate as much economic return as some of the alternative uses. So we see that as a real powerful incentive that we have put in place artificially that causes a lot of people to have to sell their farmland when it's passing from one generation to the next. And so that really leads us to say, let's take a close look at that and figure out how we remove that artificial incentive to convert agricultural land that we clearly need, with a greater emphasis on the number of people we need to feed, the environmental services coming from that land, make sure that we keep that land in an agricultural use instead of forcing it to be converted.
Do you have ideas about how that can happen?
Well, really, what we've been trying to do in our discussions on Capitol Hill is to focus on the land. And not be quite as concerned about who's holding the land or how long have people been engaged in an agricultural operation on that land, and to say, if you will in fact keep farmland in agriculture, then we want to, ideally would like to see the estate tax eliminated, but certainly reduce the amount of cost that the family is going to incur when they make that transition from one generation to the next.
Are you making those words available on deaf ears?
Well, I wouldn't say deaf ears. No, not at all. In fact, I think that it appeared as though there was an effort, particularly on the Senate side, that was about ready to go here a month or so ago, that didn't necessarily take that point of view. And I believe we have successfully gotten across the point that we really need to look at this issue, and I have no doubt there are others that are in consideration as well. But we feel pretty good about the feedback we're getting, particularly from the staff that's working on this issue on Capitol Hill right now, that they are kind of pausing, stepping back, taking a look at this particular aspect of the concerns we've raised, and hopefully they'll be addressed here as we see this issue continue to play out through the remainder of the year.
Well, let's switch topics just a bit. A recent press release from the American Farmland Trust pointed to a lack of vegetable and fruit acres in the United States, something along the lines, according to your organization, of needing about 13 million more acres just to meet the daily USDA requirements set out in that food triangle, pyramid, that is. Can you tell me more about what it is that the American Farmland Trust would like to happen?
Well, this is another area, kind of going back to my earlier point, of the many ways that we try to approach farmland preservation and promoting sound stewardship. You know, one of the things that you haven't mentioned that's interesting about that statistic is an awful lot of the land that's producing kind of direct consumption commodities, fruits and vegetables, really is the land that's most clearly in the path of development. In fact, we've found that 86% of U.S. fruits and vegetables and 63% of dairy products are produced on prime farmland in urban-influenced areas. So we feel that while there's clearly a lot of reasons to be supportive of getting more fruits and vegetables in people's diets, there's also an important consideration to understand that if you're going to have that kind of locally grown produce, you have to have the farmland. And, you know, one of our bumper stickers that's very popular that we use is no farms, no food. If we can't help protect those areas, particularly now where a lot of those kinds of products are being generated or being grown, then we're not going to have the kind of locally accessible food supplies, the fresh fruits and vegetables that people are increasingly demanding.
Is this a food insecurity tack that you're taking with Washington, D.C.?
Well, certainly that's an important part of it. You know, people, I think, are maybe a little more keenly in tune to the security of their food supply and where it's coming from in a world that's getting more and more globalized. So that's one of the arguments, one of the points we try to make. You know, there's clearly also a lot of attention being focused on the health of what people are eating. And, you know, as we've done, I think, on the farms and my farm family, certainly for my entire life, understanding the nutritional value of those kinds of products and the important part of the diets that people have on a daily basis is another important twist on this. So there's a lot of reasons to be supporting it, a lot of reasons to be concerned, and clearly the American Farmland Trust is engaged in that and seeking to address that issue as we look ahead to you know, farm bill debates and other opportunities we have along the way.
How do you relate it to urban sprawl?
Well, I think urban sprawl is related from the standpoint that if people want that kind of local produce, you know, clearly you've got to have the resources available to be able to provide that. And when you allow urban sprawl to take place and you have the corresponding impact of finding it very difficult to maintain that kind of infrastructure that you need to have to support a viable farming operation, then you're really pushing that farther and farther out. Quite often it's the best farmland that's being taken when that sprawl is taking place. So you have more vulnerable land that's more, you know, inclined to be erosive or not have the kind of soil types to get the level of productivity you want, soils that may need more fertility or whatever. Those are the kinds of impacts that I think you start to see as urban sprawl takes place. There are impacts that I think more people are becoming concerned about, and clearly things we seek to emphasize as we try to relate to people in those towns and cities as to why they should be concerned about making sure we maintain that productive agricultural base in this country.
Yeah, so you look at maintaining the productive agricultural base and possibly holding back urban sprawl, but that probably means that city centers would need to be reinvented to some respect. That maybe they need to grow up instead of out. How do you deal with city councils and well, county boards on this idea to really sell them on the idea that farmland doesn't necessarily need to be converted into a property tax base?
Well, it's certainly a challenge, and you know, we've had 30 years in this organization of seeking to address that challenge, and I have no doubt we're going to be very busy in the next 30 years continuing to try to make those points. But I guess I would say I think in a lot of ways that argument's getting a little easier to make because we do hear so much about our food supply. And, you know, the First Lady has her program focused on nutritional diets, especially for children. And a lot of that comes back to, you know, fruits and vegetables, the kind of production that seems to be especially vulnerable in the path of urban development. And so I think there's an opportunity for the agricultural community to, you know, have arguments that resonate in ways that certainly help to serve the ends that the agricultural community feel are important in ways that we didn't even see 5 to 10 years ago. One of the studies, for instance, that we've been engaged in, one of the signature items that we've done here with the American Farmland Trust was a food shed study that we did around the area of San Francisco, California, clearly an area where, you know, folks are increasingly concerned about where's their food coming from and is it local and all that kind of stuff. And we looked at the question of, you know, can that metropolitan area feed itself within 100 miles? Now, of course, they could because they've got a little bit of a unique climate there. But I think the point is it brought together the mayor of the city of San Francisco, agricultural leaders, leaders from a number of groups interested in food, interested in the social fabric of that metropolitan area, in a discussion and focused on issues relating from food accessibility to land use to a whole host of other things that I would argue is very unique and I think a good example of how we have opportunities to bring people together in ways that can address important public concerns, but also to do it in a way that can help develop or continue a thriving agricultural base.
Are you familiar, for instance, with Walmart's move to limit the number of transportation miles that they might be trucking products and in the process redevelop orchards and vegetable crop farms closer to the Midwest than they have been?
Yes, I certainly am, and I have staff that's been involved in that effort with them. And I think that's one of the things that's also helping to drive this. Clearly, you know, there's been a lot being written, a lot being spoken on radio programs like yours about where our food's coming from. But also I think you're finding a lot of very large retailers really start to weigh in on this. And that's, in fact, becoming one of the big drivers of attention or change being brought about to address these kinds of issues. And clearly Walmart, with all the good points and all the bad points that their involvement can bring, is one of the leaders in that area and certainly helping to tee this up in a way that's, I think, going to help to bring about some change.
What other issues are you taking up there in the American Farmland Trust in terms of legislation at this point?
Well, everybody's talking about the Farm Bill, or at least within the Beltway they are, and I think this is even getting more prevalent outside when you talk to commodity group leaders and even talk to farmers. I think they understand that Chairman Peterson in particular, Chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, is doing a round of hearings across the country. I think everybody's painfully aware of the budget challenges, the budget problems we've got in the federal government and really governments across the country. And they understand that, you know, farm programs, we're going to have to redouble efforts and work very hard to make sure that they're focused on, you know, programs and providing services that not only help agriculture but also can get public support. And we're certainly doing what we need to do to gear up to continue to play hopefully a viable and important role in farm policy debate on a whole host of issues from conservation to farmland preservation to renewable energy to, you know, really how do you provide a public investment in agriculture in a way that helps farmers but doesn't distort markets and have some corresponding environmental problems that we need to address.
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Our guest today on the phone line from Washington, D.C. is John Shull, the president of the American Farmland Trust. More in a moment.
It's National Hazelnut Cake Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1857, a farmer, James Gibbs of Mill Point, Virginia, invented the first practical U.S. chain stitch sewing machine. It went for $50, half the price of anything similar of the day. In 1886, U.S. President Grover Cleveland married Frances Folsom, with a ceremony taking place in the White House. Cleveland is the only president to be married in the White House. In 1928, Velveeta cheese was created by Kraft. It was packaged in a tin foil lined wooden box. When melted, it was smooth as velvet, hence the name. By the way, Kraft's first factory was in Stockton, Illinois in 1914. In 1943, John Frank Stevens died. Stevens, an American civil engineer, was in charge of the Panama Canal project from 1905 to 1907. He planned the major features of the waterway and lobbied openly for a high-level type lock canal, which was realized with the president's signature in 1906. And in 2003, the USDA declared that frozen, batter-coated French fries are fresh vegetables. And a year later, a federal judge agreed, saying the term fresh vegetables was ambiguous. By the way, USDA had unsuccessfully tried in 1981 to classify ketchup and pickle relish as vegetables. Public protest caused them to drop the idea. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest today, John Scholl of the American Farmland Trust. Mr. Scholl, when we last talked, you had just discussed some of the legislation that's coming up, the 2012 Farm Bill. Have you been listening with great interest to what Chairman Peterson has been saying and hearing as he goes out into the nation and talks to producers? And what kinds of ideas might the American Farmland Trust have for the next set of farm programs?
Well, certainly have been listening with great interest. I certainly admire Chairman Peterson and the leadership that he's providing on this issue. I think it is important that we get out and get an early start, that we do the listening, which is going to be a very important part of this whole process, to make sure as we head into what I'm sure is going to be a very contentious and difficult debate, once again, that we have the good ideas on the table, that we've thoroughly vetted things. And I think the chairman deserves a lot of credit for getting out early and moving as aggressively as he is. There are several things that I think in terms of what we're hearing that is important to us. One of the things clearly is a focus on a revenue base for farm support programs. You may or may not know that the American Farmland Trust was one of the principal leaders in developing the ACRE program in the last round, worked very closely with the National Corn Growers to promote a concept which, again, listening to your program, I know has been a hot topic and I think gaining momentum. And clearly, as the chairman has spoken and he's had these hearings, I think some sort of revenue-based approach is something that a lot of people are taking a hard look at. The other thing that I would focus on in a general sense is the environmental and conservation programs. And I think you're hearing even more about that route right now because of the oil spill. In fact, a person told me just this morning, I haven't seen this myself, but there's apparently signs around town that say beaches have never closed because of an ethanol spill. And I think, you know, what agriculture can do to help contribute to energy security, to help contribute to environmental security, is going to be an increasingly important part of the next Farm Bill discussion, as it has been for the last couple of rounds of farm policy debate.
On conservation of farmland, and in particular the conservation activities of producers, do you think that it would be wise in this Farm Bill to discuss the ideas of paying producers more on what they do on the farm rather than the kinds of products that they're producing, so that if they have buffer zones, if they have waterways, if they're no-till or low-till, that they might reap some kind of investment into their farm from the federal government as opposed to direct payments?
I think it's not only wise, it's critical. I think part of the drivers that we're seeing in this whole Farm Bill debate that we're leading up to here is an increased concern about, you know, why are we paying farmers to do what we're paying them to do? And a lot of that goes to, you know, supporting specific commodities. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that agriculture is a huge part of the solution to a lot of environmental challenges this country faces. and, you know, trying to help farmers be able to have the expertise and the resources necessary to capture that opportunity and fulfill that need is critically important, and that certainly is part of this farm bill debate. I also think it's important because I think we're making progress in the public understanding that agriculture is an important part of that solution. And while they're getting increasingly concerned about, you know, farm program commodity payments that's been building here over the last number of decades, I think they're also much more willing to listen to what is it you can do on the farm that we can help you do that can address some real top-of-mind issues that we continue to hear about. And so I think it's not only a necessity, it's an opportunity we have in this next Farm Bill policy discussion to say, you know, how, in addition to making farmers the best corn and soybean producers, for instance, can we do, but also how can we help them be the best producers of environmental benefits that I think agriculture is uniquely positioned to provide and that clearly the public can be very supportive of and, in fact, wanting very much.
Okay, one last topic, and it'll be a different one. We'll go back to locally sourced food just a bit. Can I take you to Detroit, where there's been a mass population dispersal from the center town center, which sets on the lake, to about 8 miles out? Almost everybody is gone, apparently. And so there are these large tracts of property and land that have abandoned homes and neighborhoods there. And there's some talk within Detroit that they might want to convert some of that into farmland or into gardens. What kinds of things do you think are possible and should be done in that sort of situation?
Well, when I look at that, you know, first of all, I understand that we're not going to probably ever get to a point where you're totally going to feed the city of Detroit with production in those areas. Clearly, all of agriculture is needed to feed the growing demand for food that we continue to see. But I also think very quickly about a point that, you know, I've heard farmers talk about around board tables of organizations for years, and that's concern about the lost connection that seems to be taking place between consumers and the producers of our food. And I'm personally of the belief that anything we can do to engage more people in, you know, be it gardening, you know, agriculture on a small scale, whatever the case might be, we're going to do more to help people understand what it really takes and the challenges that we have of producing food that, you know, I think farmers are keenly aware of, but too many other people aren't. So I look at that and say, what a terrific opportunity to help communicate, you know, some very basic tenets of, you know, agriculture, farming, and what it takes to put food on the table, that opportunities like that present to us, even involved in mainstream agriculture.
Mr. Scholl, thank you so much for being with us. John Scholl is the president of the American Farmland Trust. You can find them online at farmland.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.